Welcome to the Brad and Body Podcast. You already know who we are. We wouldn't be here, so let's not waste any more time. Here's Bradley.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the post-WNBL Grand Final Series. What a series it was. Welcome to the Brad and Body Podcast. Botty, how was that, mate? What a week.
Yes, it was an extraordinary series and so different. Three games that could not have been more different. And in the end, you know, when I saw Guy Malloy hugging all of his starters as they walked in to start the game against Perth for the deciding game three, I thought, now there's an emotional component here. Perth doesn't have a chance in this. And then as soon as Tess Madden hit her second three-pointer, you know, I thought, she hadn't been playing particularly well offensively. Now she was. You had Lindsay Allen. Yeah, it was over and done with.
Fantastic. We'll go in a little bit more to talk about that after I introduce our next guest. Now, this one, how do I put it? He is just a legend of our sport.
Yep.
Refereed over 945 games. I think that's more than points I scored, Boddy, in the NBL. Yeah. But this guy is a legend of our sport. He actually, which I didn't know, played 77 VFL games and was the club's most improved player in 19... Sorry, yes, that wasn't a mumble. I just thought I'd say that for him. For the St Kilda team. And what a fantastic career it was. But it was in 1990, after an approach from Basketball Australia, that this man gave up his job as a teacher to become the Basketball Australia's referee manager. He then went on and held the position for 15 years, quickly building a fantastic reputation as was. He then refereed every grand final from 1987 until he retired in 2011, after 32 years being involved. At this time, he was the record holder that I said, and then he was also inducted into the Australian Hall of Fame. He stood until Australian Hall of Fame inductee Ray Hunt passed him, and that was just phenomenal. This man is, when you think of referees, it was him, wasn't it, Boddy? There was
absolutely
no question about that.
First choice.
He went to umpteen games. He went to Olympic games, and we're going to get into those. He did world championships, and he is the man, and we are going to introduce him now. Billy Mildenhall, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks very much, guys. Can I just make mention here the number of games? You realise my best friend is Ray Hunt, and we started playing basketball together in under-12s.
Wow.
And then he still came out as a good friend. He beat me with the number of games. And, you know, I mean, he lost me, you know, as the best friend when he then went back for another year just to make sure that he beat me with a number of games.
That's a very poor effort by Ray.
Yeah.
Now, Bill, we're gonna take you through your whole career, but before we do that, there's been a question that I've wanted to ask you for 30 years, exactly 30 years, and finally get the chance. So I'm going to throw it right at you right now. When you saw at the Barcelona Olympics, when you got your roster, or when you knew that you were going to be reffing the dream team, what was your first reaction? Like, how did you react to that? Because, I mean, this is Michael Jordan, Larry Bird, Magic Johnson, Patrick Ewing. These are the legends of the game that we all knew, and you as a referee absolutely knew. When you see that you're going to call that team, what was your reaction?
Obviously, firstly, you're just rapt to get to the Olympic Games, and then to actually have the dream team there for the very first time, the professionals involved. There was always the thought that, I wonder whether I was lucky enough to get one of their games. It was also helpful that they're in a different pool from Australia, so that you're never in the same pool as the country is. So that sort of gave me an option as well. And then they played the first game, and then the appointment's coming out, they just post it under your door in your hotel room. So you get a little note saying that, you know, you're refereed. So I was just ringing every person. But that game was just an incredible experience. One, for being able to officiate the dream team. But secondly, there was some massive stories attached. Or not massive. There was a little story attached to the game that sort of made it a little bit even more interesting, I guess, which is to do with, they played the first game 2 days earlier. And so then the guy in charge of the referees had come into our referees room, and I was refereeing with a Chinese guy by the name of Zhu. And Zhu was a real character as a referee, and I'd refereed with him at a world championship, so I knew him. And Zhu didn't have very good English, and so the guy who came in, who was in charge of the referees, walked into the room and just said, "Did you see the Dream Team play their first game?" And I said, "Oh, of course we did. I mean, all of the world just about watched the game." So he said, "Oh, did you notice that Charles Barkley had been hanging on the ring when he dunked the ball?" And I looked at Zhu, and Zhu's got a big smile on his face. He's got no idea what he's talking about. So I said, I didn't think it was that, you know, noticeable or that bad. He said, "Well, I want you to text Al Barkley if he hangs on the ring."
Wow.
I said, "Oh, you've got to be joking." You know, this is like in front of whatever millions of people watching the game. And poor Zhu, he doesn't know what he's talking about. So I go, "I've got no one to help me." And so I said, "Oh, okay." So we get out on the floor and just go up and shake hands with the coaches, and went up he died.
Chuck Daly.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so I went up to him and just introduced myself and then shook hands. And I just said, "Look, do you mind just warning Barkley if he just hangs on the, you know, if he dunks the ball, not to hang on the ring, because I've been told to, you know, give him a tech foul." And I promise you, this is what he said to me. He turned to me and he said, "Throw the mother out of here. We don't want him anyway."
Wow.
Obviously, he was really hard to handle and they couldn't sort of control him and whatever. And that's true story. That's fact that he said that to me.
So did it happen? Did he hang on the ring?
Well, there's more to the story. This is the whole point. So we go up and down and he comes and he steals the ball once and he actually dunks it. And someone must have said something to him, because at the same time, the bench called for a timeout, and a timeout signal and a technical foul signal, you know, are somewhat close, you know, like one's at finger.
I see where this is going. Yeah, go. Yeah.
He thinks now that I've called a technical foul on him. So he goes bananas. You know, he comes over and he stands like I'm 6 foot or 5'11" or something. And, you know, he just towered over the top of me and he's abusing the hell out of me, swearing at me, carrying on. And I'm going, "Hey, it's only a timeout. It's not a technical foul." I said, "By the same token, for what you're saying to me now, I could give you 5 technical fouls." So, anyway, we pacified it and the game went on. And there's a sort of a bit of vision later where he actually dunks the ball and lets go of the ring really quickly. And he looks across and I'm giving him a thumbs up as, you know, "Well done. Good on you. You did it well." Yeah, so that was my introduction to the... And, like, as a referee, when you get to those events, it's competitive as well, because you want to get, one, you want to get more games, as many games as you can, and secondly, you want to be considered for finals and so on. And so the guy came in after the game and charged the referees and said, "I could have strangled you." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Because you didn't tech foul him." I said, "Well, I didn't think it would require a technical foul, but I just thought by just giving him a warning was the most appropriate." So he apparently went back and looked at the video and then said, "Yes, you've done the right thing," and so on. So it didn't hinder me for the rest of the series. But yeah, that was my whole introduction to the Dream Team.
I want to know why Billy wasn't on The Last Dance telling that story. All right, so we move on now. Billy, I want to go back. You obviously right into Australian rules, and I remember in the era before the sort of NBL became the NBL, pretty much every good basketball or anything around basketball came out of Victoria. That's how I grew up in New South Wales, right? So obviously you grew up, and I want to ask, was it always, you know, Aussie rules and basketball secondary? How did that start?
Yeah, I like all kids, I played basketball, footy, cricket, whatever, and cricket in the summer and so on. And I played basketball, as I said, at juniors, we started, I think, in under 12s or whatever. And Ray Hunt, my, you know, compatriot referee, he was playing in a year, he was a couple of years older than I, so he was playing in the level above me in basketball. And he was always, I thought it was a better basketball than I was. So we sort of played junior basketball all the way along till about under 18s. And then once I'd finished out of under 18s, I realised that I wasn't going to be any great shakes of a player, but I was still interested in sport and I still really liked it. So I sort of wanted to be involved in the sport for as long as I possibly could. So officiating was an option. And in all honesty, the other option was is a means of making some pocket money. So instead of selling papers on the corner, it was a way of me sort of just earning some money and being involved in the sport. So all the way along then, I was still playing junior footy. So I started under 16 footy. And then... and obviously was a little better in footy so that I sort of pursued my football career a bit longer and ended up at St Kilda for 10 years or whatever. But in that time, I was still able to keep on refereeing. And that's another sort of interesting story in itself that I played 10 years at St Kilda, I would have played probably more games in the reserves than I did in the seniors. But a lot of the times I'd referee a game on a Saturday, the reserves would play before the seniors, and then I'd sneak off and race off to and referee a basketball game that night of NBL when NBL first started and so on. So there was a period of time when I was playing footy and officiating and trying to sort of cover both. And during the footy season, I'd sneak off from training on a Wednesday night in Albert Park. Wednesday night was like our state championships, basically. And I'd sort of sneak off in a tracksuit or whatever, get changed while I was driving the car, and then into my basketball refereeing gear and then go off and referee again.
So at what point did you come to that conclusion that, right, I'm going to give football away and I'm going to take up full time, or I'm get really going to throw myself into basketball officiating? How did that happen?
No, that didn't really happen. I got my marching orders from football. So when I was just that, wasn't my choice.
Okay, so it wasn't your call.
Billy, there's probably about 85 basketball players that are thinking, geez, I wish you got your marching orders from basketball.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the wrong people gave me the tap on the shoulder. So at one stage, at St Kilda, I think I played 10 or 12 games a season before or whatever. But what happened is in the grand final of the reserves at St Kilda, I dislocated my collarbone on my shoulder in the middle of your chest. So it's a really unusual. So I ended up in hospital and having an operation and so on. And so then I came back to pre-season training the next season. And at the time, Alex Jesolenko was coach. And Jezza came up to me and he said, you've got to be 32 this year or whatever. I think it was 32. He said, I couldn't play league football at 32. So he said, you've got no chance of playing 32. So I said, oh, you know, what happens? He said, oh, well, if you can arrange a swap with another league player or money, we think it's time for you to move on. So I said, okay.
Did you ever play basketball, like, as in that was – I know you said you played, but did you play as in train, team or anything, or was it just social?
No, I mean, we were playing under 18 state championships level.
Okay.
Victoria, but not to any shakes and terms. I didn't make a state team or a state training squad or anything of that nature.
Yeah, but, you and me both. Don't worry about that.
Who were you playing for, Bill?
We played with St Kilda Police Boys originally. So Ray and I both. And St Kilda Police Boys became, in the early phases of NBL, it was St Kilda Biz Houses.
Yes.
So that was the club that we actually played with. And we were both, Ray was in Paran and I was born and bred in St Kilda. So I sort of, that was just normal for us to go there.
And when was the time, Billy, that you were like, all right, I can go somewhere in this and I'm a good referee? Where did that click?
When I started I took up officiating, it was for the money.
Yep.
I think it was probably about 12 months in, a guy by the name of John Holden came up to me. And John Holden, I then since found out that he'd been to three Olympic Games as a referee, Australian referee.
Fabulous ref, yep.
Yeah, and so he was fantastic. He sort of took me under his wing a little and just said, listen, you know, he even came around to, I vividly remember this, he came around to my house once to sort of just to give me a bit of a pat on the back to say, you know, look, you can referee. He said, I'd love to see you pursue, you know, your career and whatever. So he gave me a real helping hand. And another guy by the name of Les Dick, who was a sort of the, he was a senior referee and was also the president of the Referees Association. And I nearly blew my chances. This is really true. When I was 17, I think, 17 or 18, I hadn't long been out of a referee school. And he was at Albert Park on a Friday night, and he came up to me and he Les was a bit of a drinker and he was a bit of a knockabout bloke and so on. And so this guy came up to me and he said, what's your name, Sonny? And I was really close to sort of saying, so I said, oh, you know, who wants to know? And he said, I'm Les Dick, I'm the president of the Victorian Basketball Referees Association. And I was so close to saying, yeah, and I'm the president of the United States. You know, I just didn't believe who he was. And so luckily I did sort of give him my name and stuff. So he really took me under his wing. So he used to look after another night at Tuesday nights at Albert Park. And so he used to get me to come down and referee his night at Albert Park. And he would always put me on court one, on the major court with sort of senior referees and sit up there. And he gave me individual coaching basically for a 12-month period or whatever. So then, you know, I thought, oh, well, maybe I'm okay at this. So I sort of, but again, it was just purely when John Holt came around and said, look, you know, there is an opportunity here. The ultimate is you could go to an Olympic Games. So that's made me somewhat sort of interested because I'm, you know, underneath it all, I was a frustrated athlete. I just want to go to Olympic Games as a player, not as a bloody referee. But
sure,
that was the next best thing, I guess. So that was always sort of an ambition along the way. And then you just, I mean, it's not something you'd look at, you know, on a regular basis, just something, oh, shit, it'd be great to get to an Olympic Games if you could. So, you know, yeah. And I mean, Olympic Games are the ultimate, but also the World Championships are pretty important too. So, you know, there was always the opportunity of the Olympics and World Championships, which is pretty exciting too.
Now, Bill, you had a great reputation as a referee. I mean, people saw you walk out for the game to do their game. They'd be thrilled to see you. And they go, all right, that's something we don't have to worry about. We're going to get good officiating. The question I have for you is, do you think that by playing at such a high level at that time with St Kilda, that because you already understood what the athlete goes through, do you think that helped you in terms of just your ability to relate to the players and make common sense and decisions?
I think it helped enormously. Yeah, I really. The interesting one was when we had imports come out here for the first time, and yep. I can always remember. I can't remember the name, but I was just about to toss the ball at the start of a game, and he turns to me, "Hey man, you play that silly game Aussie Rules?" I'm really admiring you, man. I admire you. You know, so it really sort of helped you right from the very beginning. You know, they broke down a number of things. And I think also I sort of probably had a little more empathy or understanding of what the frustrations of officials are to players. And so, you know, I think it sort of it probably did help.
Billy, what was the biggest challenge you've got when you come to refereeing? Now, I'm talking, is it travel? Is it fitness? Because, you know, I don't think a lot of people would realise what you as referees would have to go through. You run more kilometres on the court than anyone. There's substitutions, there's in and outs, there's timeout. You guys get none of that. Mm-hmm. What's the biggest challenge?
Yeah, I guess the fitness aspect of things is relevant. I mean, for me, the irony of all of that is that into my sort of, I don't know, 10 years into career or whatever, the FIBA, the international body, decided to introduce a fitness testing program for referees. So we had to do the beep test and then we moved on to the yo-yo test. And I was, at that stage, I was working then for Basketball Australia. So I introduced the fitness testing program for our referees in Australia. And the irony of all of that is you had to complete your fitness testing, you had to make a particular level to do NBL. And the reason I stopped refereeing NBL is because I failed the fitness test.
Oh, wow. What was the number?
I can't remember now. But I introduced the bloody fitness test and then it came back to bite me on the backside because I failed.
What was your best? Do you remember?
I remember Ray Hunt. We did it with, it was Ray Hunt did 17.2 or something. I think wow. That sounds, yeah, that was massive. It was
my best was, I know, 15.9. And I can tell you, I was sprinting at the end.
Yeah.
And we did that one year with the Kings, and being obviously the smaller one, I was always that one that could last that longest. Oh, yeah. Mate, that's unbelievable. No,
Ray's 17.2. And I think we did have to make 16. I think that sort of sounded familiar. So it was, wow. It was, but you have to, you know, had to have done. And I'd had a bit of an injury, and so I wasn't able to. This is my excuse anyway. That I wasn't able to sort of prepare as best I could, and so it, and sort of came back. And it's pretty hard when at that stage I was sort of in a little bit in charge of our FIBA referees and so on. So I couldn't sort of, you know, change the rules and say, oh, well, we'll let this guy off.
We'll make one exception.
Let's make it 15 for this year.
Yeah, or whatever, exactly. Yeah. So that was my end of my officiating at the NBL level. That was it.
Did you find that when they went to three officials that added a couple of years onto your career, perhaps?
Yeah, it did. Though, mind you, we still did have to do the fitness test anyway.
Sure,
but I think,
sure.
Marie, I think we may have reduced the level that you had to reach. Yeah, it did. And that was part of the aim of three-person as well. You know, there were a number of reasons for the introduction of that. And one of them was to help develop younger referees coming through because you sort of weren't exposing somebody, you know, to the pressures of the game because you could sort of protect them a little bit. And secondly, it gave some further longevity to experienced people, which was, you know, so there were a number of reasons, along with the fact that the game was just becoming so quick and so much happening that it was very difficult for two people to really adjudicate. So, you know, I mean, so all of those reasons, you know, added to the fact of the introduction of three-person.
I've got so many questions. I'm going to come back to the biggest crybaby, but I'll come back to that. But what I want to know is, I'm thinking, you know, early 90s, this league has just gone bang. You've got 15,000 people at the, you know, or 10 at the Entertainment Centre, 15 at the Melbourne Centre. What is it like for a referee to walk out of there? Because you've got to remember, as a player, I'm thinking you want those juices, you want to run up and down, but as a referee, you've got to stay in that zone. What's it like going through that?
Yeah, I mean, the growth of the sport was incredible, and we were sort of just caught up in that whole growth. You know, when it first started, when I was referring to NBL, we were at Albert Park, we had 500 people, I think we were lucky. Then I vividly remember going out to a game, and I think it was a Melbourne Tigers game, or it might have been even Australia, and it was the first game we'd played at the Tennis Centre, and we walked up to Lindsay. And then Lindsay was coaching. So it could have been the Australian team. So Lindsay, you know, just you go up and shake hands, you know, good luck or whatever. And Lindsay turned to me and said, Billy, how good is this?
No, that's and great.
He said, went ape shit, you know, like he was going crazy. Billy, there's 15,000 people here. They were watching us. So I said, yeah, well, good luck, you know, hope you win. I couldn't care less. I don't care. I'm just so pumped. He was so genuinely wrapped of the fact that there was people there, and so that, you know, so you get caught up in the euphoria of that sort of stuff. Was fantastic. And we graduated from there, across the road at the old Olympic Park, the Olympic swimming pool that they'd converted into the glass house, you know. Yep. So we were getting I think 8,000 were in those games, and so, you know, that was enormous to get that sort of crowd. And then to go across the road, it was a big gamble to go across and play, you know, at the Tennis Centre. But it was great to be part of that whole sort of. And from a referee, yeah, look, at the end of the day, you don't really notice once you, I mean, it sounds cliche, but you don't really notice the crowd so much. It's just when you first walk out there, there's enormous
people. Yeah, I remember that as a player, 100%. Yeah. While you're in the game, you could be in front of two people, not 1,000. Yeah, I get
correct.
That.
Correct, yeah. And so you sort of, I mean, obviously you get reactions, but the reactions, it then becomes a bit of a buzz around the place rather than sort of a, unless you make something really crucial that's, you know, everybody boos you. It's generally speaking, a buzz rather than
that. You wouldn't have had that too often, would you?
Oh, no, I think I may have had my share of those. Yeah.
Well, so you were saying basically that even though the crowd it can be a huge crowd, say we're talking 15,000, and they're really supporting the home team, that it's not influencing you on the floor in any way, shape or form. Because there are times, I think the referees seem to go with the momentum. You know, a team starts to come back from 10 down, it's the home team, say, the crowd starts roaring, and suddenly they seem to get a bunch of calls that go with them too. So I always thought, no, sometimes they can swap in it. You're saying you don't?
You'd have to be unrealistic to sort of say, of course, that you're going to get caught up with the euphoria of the, there's going to be things that I don't think you do consciously, but there's no question that you're going to get caught up with that sort of stuff.
I told you, buddy. Billy always screwed me when I was on the road. I told you, it's true. It's true.
Oh, yeah. You were playing in front of 500, though, so.
And yeah. I was on the bench, but it was true.
It was just your mum and dad yelling at me all the time. That's what he said. But it's, no, look, I think it happens in all sports. You know, like it's unrealistic. Say that it doesn't occur, but you know obviously you don't want to ever be accused of ever, you know, favouring any team whatsoever, and you work your butt off to eliminate that. But I don't know subconsciously how much the crowds can affect, and that's why people want to play at home and play in front of their home crowds and all that sort of stuff, because there's impact on that.
Okay, I've got another one to follow on from that. And that is whether you ever felt when you were doing an international game that you needed to square up because the other referee, let's say someone, it might have been, his name may have been Davidoff, I don't know. But I remember a game at Apollo where the Opals were playing a team from what was the other side of the Iron Curtain at the time. And the Opals were winning, and suddenly Davidoff made a bunch of calls that sort of put the opposition back into the game, and he made a really bad play. It was so obvious that he was favouring a particular team. And as soon as they throw in the ball, I believe you called a travel, and we got the ball back now. Did you feel that you needed to even up because the guy was just out of control?
There are some times when, particularly in those sort of exhibition games and so on, you know, when they're not.
Yeah.
I mean, it's different from world championships, Olympics and stuff. There's no question that you, if you feel like somebody's sort of screwing your country or whatever your team, you do. Yeah. I had this incredible experience that I can't even remember, but it was an American team that came out here. It was an all-star team, and they were playing Australia, and Lindsay was coach. And we're at the glass house, and the scores were really close. It was close near the end, and the score table people didn't switch the clock on. So Australia stole the ball, went down and made the basket, and it was still showing 7 seconds on the clock, you know, and it should have ticked down and whatever. Anyway, yep. so it allows Australia to win. And we had to make a decision, you know, whether it would count or not count, you know, whether it was going to be turned. So Lindsay came up to me really quietly and just said, "Billy, you are in Australia. You are an Australian. We must win." And so I was under a little bit of pressure. So I would say, okay, yeah, the points count. So we counted the points and we ran. We ran off the court. Trying to get away. And this is true. This is a true story. Do you remember the guy named Jim Foster?
Yes.
Buddy, you'd probably know him. He played.
Yes.
Yep. He ended up came out here as an American and came out. I think he played with Coburg, and he actually finally got deported because he was doing some tax dodges or something. Well, anyway, whatever happened to him. But this Jim Foster was this big American guy. Well, he chased us into the change rooms, into the rooms of the glass house, and we get to the glass house, and the door to our change room was locked. So we're on trying to hide, and we're stuck up against the wall. So we're leaning up against the wall to try and make out so he can't see us. So we're trying to hide from him. And eventually he didn't actually catch up with us because he would have killed us. Honestly, he was so angry. He was going to, and then lo and behold, then a week later, I was playing basketball domestically at Albert Park. And on court one, and the team must have been there to train or whatever, and he recognised me playing, so he raced up, grabbed the whistle off the referee, and called a foul off.
All right, Billy, I've got one big question for you, and I just want a name. Who was the biggest crybaby in the NBL? Come on, throw it out there.
Oh, sure. Look, that's a really tough one to ask because there's so many. I mean, there were so many players over
there. There's so many.
And all at different stages and different times they were winning. I'm actually a reasonably good mate, and Larry will hate this. I'm really good mates with Larry Sensog. But Larry used to be, I can vividly remember him being a fairly perennial whinger about officiating. So, and I mean, he wasn't sort of, he wasn't over the top. He just used to not necessarily agree with our calls terribly much.
Great. And we'll be getting Larry on there soon and we'll have a chat about that, no problem. Billy, it's that time of the show of what we do.
Oh, yeah. Larry never failed.
Yeah, exactly. Billy, it's that time of the show, and what we do is we just throw a name at you. Billy, Boddy and I are going to do probably three each, and all we want is just a word. What, when I say, or Billy, sorry, or Boddy says the name, what is the first thing that comes in your mind? One word, one sentence, an antidote, whatever it is. And I'm going to start it off with, and you have mentioned him a lot on this show, but I'll start it, Ray Hunt.
Just best mate.
Lovely.
Okay, I've got Ken Cole.
Interesting character.
Oh, good. All right, I'm going to go again. Leroy Loggins.
Great bloke and player.
Chuck Daly.
I've used the word interesting before, haven't I? So... He was unique.
Unique. I like that one. Okay. My last one. Mal Hollywood Cooper.
Hollywood is appropriate name for him.
All right. And my last one for you is Ray Borner.
No. What did I say about Ray? No, he's a good guy. I'm friends with Ray. I'm friends with Ray as well. I don't know whether you've ever... There was one story I had with him with... we were standing in two shots and he said, Billy, can you get a technical foul for what you're thinking? And I said to him, no, you can't. He said, I think you're an arsehole.
Yeah, great story. I was so hoping you'd give us that story.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. Billy,
great story.
When I see him now, he reckons he wants a dollar for every time I've told the story. He reckons he'd be a millionaire by now.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
not only that, I reckon a bunch of referees have appropriated that story too and turned it into something that happened to them.
I think I probably pinched it from somewhere.
Billy, we could go on. You're tremendous. And look, I sort of always talk about people and I say what they mean to me. And I remember when I joined the Sydney Kings and I'd come out and you were the referee, it felt like royalty was there. That's the aura that you had for players. That's the aura that you certainly had for me.
Yep.
What you were able to do for this sport was phenomenal. You are revered as a coach, as a referee. You've been unbelievable of what you've done, and thank you for helping our sport grow into what it is today. You've set a benchmark that other referees can only hope to achieve. So thank you so much for joining us today, and we really, really appreciate you coming on.
I really appreciate your kind words. I think you're going a little over the top, I might add.
But so do I. So do I, but yeah, that's yeah.
He does that, but in saying that,
I'm not going to referee him anymore, so I can't help you in any way anymore. Well, just one thing I would make the point now, though, it's back in our day and when we were playing and officiating, the culture and the circumstances are so different. And I feel for referees now, because the accountability for officiating now is just it's completely out of the water, in terms of everything is analysed to the nth degree. Where it's looked at slow motion replay, you know, from five different angles and all those sort of things, which makes it efficient, so difficult. And it takes away the personalities of the people. So, you know, there were times in our games where, okay, you know, you're 20 points behind, the ball goes out of bounds, comes, you know, just touches your leg or whatever, but, nobody sort of noticed. You just give it back to the team who were 20 points behind. Nobody would bitch, nobody would complain, and the game would progress. Now you can't do that, you know, because then they'll show it on replay and they'll show a different angle and they'll criticise the referee for the decision-making. So it has changed, and I must admit I'd hate to be officiating now, because the personalities of people have really been taken from them, where it's just you have to be technically correct in every single call that you make. And I think that sort of makes it. And, look, that's across the board in all sports. It's not just basketball.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Footy's exactly the same.
And that's cameras have done, slow motions and angles. Yeah, and, you know, you get 1,000 cameras now at sporting venues and you just can't miss a thing. And it's a great point you make, Bill. It's a great point.
And it's really there as well, because you don't get that option. In basketball, you can go to the video replay on some of the, you know, decisions. But when you're still making a split-second decision, you have to make that, you know, the ultimate decision there and then. So you don't get the option of being able to look at it five times in replay. And I always was of the opinion that if you had to look at something five times, then whatever your decision was in the first place is what we should be going with, you know, on that. But you're right, it's technology, and we have to embrace that, and we have to embrace the fact that, so personalities, I think, have sort of been unfortunately taken out of all sports, where, you know, it's not quite the same anymore. It's far more analytical and just everything is, you know, black and white.
Good point. And on that note, Billy, we will finish. That was absolutely fantastic. And again, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. Yep.
All right.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
Good chat with the referees. Yeah. I love them.
Yes.
He was
the best.
A good sport. And I can say that to all our listeners, when Boddy called him and said, "Hey, do you want to come on?" He was absolutely chuffed, wasn't he, Boddy?
Yes, he was thrilled that he hadn't been forgotten. And you can't forget him, because, I mean, he's mentioned John Holden, who was a great referee from a previous era. But in the era of the NBL, you know, Bill was number one for longer than anyone else, and rightly so. So tell me, talking about NBL, anything for you come out of this round? I mean,
I think the good are standing up. You know, like you saw the good teams that just, you know, needed to get wins, and Sydney, Illawarra, Melbourne, Perth, they're all sort of saying, you know, galloping home to the finish line, and now it's just a matter of whether will they finish. Southeast Melbourne, they're going to have to do some soul searching in the off season, what they do, and Tasmania, it's a tick, and now really the challenge will start for to Tasmania, because now it's the second year they've got to try and get that going, but we'll talk about that later. But what about you, anything?
No, not really. I was you know, like the first game there where Melbourne has put South East Melbourne out of its misery officially. I mean, we already knew it, but that's how the round started. And yeah, I didn't see a lot in the round that was of great significance. It's just like, well, we're getting towards the end now. Here it is. The good stuff has sort of moved away from the mediocre and the bad. So yeah, it's where we.
Which so
talking about mediocre and bad, give us a Rosen Rattler.
Well, mine comes out of Brisbane. Now, obviously, they've had a woeful year, but what I am loving is Tom Digbo.
Yeah.
I'm really enjoying that kid. He's sort of, you know, he's starting to get his chance now. He's a next star. And obviously, with, you know, the injuries they had and the position they're in, James Duncan is giving him a lot more minutes. Man, he is super athletic, runs the floor. There's got to be some NBA scouts looking at that going, okay, what can we do with that?
Yeah, well, I mean, following on from that, you know, Ousmane Dieng from the other night, you know, when he's come out and he's perfect 6 of 6 at halftime with 17 points and 4 3-pointers in that lot. He's really now making the most. Like earlier in the season, I thought he was getting chances that he didn't warrant, unlike Tom at Brisbane, who probably did warrant chances that he wasn't getting you know, the other way around.
Yeah.
But Dieng is certainly finishing with a flurry, and so is Digbo. It's been good to watch. I agree with you.
What about Hugo Besson? I love that name. Hugo Besson. What about him? What do you think?
We all do. I think he's probably, he's a little erratic for mine at this stage. When he's, boy, is he fun to watch, seriously. But also he has long patches where he's not going, where his youth shows out. Yeah, you know, he still hasn't got that level of consistency across his game, but he's going to be a player for sure. But yeah, Hugo Besson, I always think of when I was in France, you know, and you try to remember, because French people aren't real thrilled about English speakers, so you try to remember what you learnt in high school French, and all I could remember was jambon for ham and fromage for cheese, so I was eating a lot of ham and cheese baguettes right across France. That's all I could say
all right,
in French.
Give me a nasty.
Oh, look, my nasty is the fact that the NBL is now fining coaches, and Scott Morrison is the first to fall victim to this, $1,000 for any audible obscenities in a timeout. And I think that, frankly, I think that's bullshit, because if you're going to go into a timeout, you're privy to a sanctuary of hearing what these coaches are saying, and you're, that's a fantastic opportunity you have. But it comes with risk. So if you're going to go in and you're going live and the coach says something that you don't want your kids to hear, well, that's just too bad. What they should do maybe is go into the timeout, take the timeout, and then do what the NBA does, maybe play an excerpt from it later so that you're in control of what's going to air. To find coaches and to say to them, oh, look, you know, this is not a privilege. It is absolutely a privilege to go into a timeout, but to say it's not and you have to watch your P's and Q's, that to me is bullshit. Okay, that's it. I'm done. What do you got? Anything? We're leaving?
No, look.
You're very quiet.
I can see both sides of it, you know, and that does come from the commentary side as well, where, you know, we get the option. My understanding is if you take your team and you stand up on the court, then you can't have the cameras in there. And that's the sort of leave me alone, don't come in there. I just think the access that we get is so good that other sports don't have. And obviously they're trying to hone that down so kids don't have to listen to it. It's very hard. Very hard. I see absolute both sides to it. Absolute both. Mate, that was a good week. I enjoyed that. Congratulations to the Melbourne Boomers. Obviously, we had Guy Malloy on a couple of weeks ago, Sammy Whitcomb, which thank you for all the feedback. That was a great little
half feedback
there. But it was congratulations to them and what a game. Lindsay Allen. Wow, man. She can hoop.
She's a star. Absolutely. Yep. All right. See you next week.
All right. Thanks, everyone. Thank you to our big sponsors, Burger Boss. We love them. Thank you so much. And to Piranha Media, thank you, everything. Buddy, have a fantastic week. Everyone, enjoy the NBL, and we'll see you next time.
So how good was Billy? I mean, I think you read out the stat that he's done, or did every grand final from 1987 to 2011. You think about that. That's more grand finals than the Perth Wildcats have played in.
Boom, boom. I'll tell you what, how good of a man, though, if you're reffing Charles Barkley and he's going off at you at the Olympics. Mate, what are you doing that for? And you just want to say to him, hey, you cry, baby. It's just a timeout, mate. Sit down. Oh, that would have been awesome.
Absolutely.